and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a response to President Trump's State of the Union, in which he appeared to be laying the groundwork for declaring a national emergency to build his border wall. Laura Munoz-Lopez, a special assistant for immigration policy at the Center for American Progress, where she has an article, Seven of the Top Immigration Lies from the Trump Administration, joins us. We will discuss the fact that apprehensions on the southern border have declined by 75% since 2000, yet the president built his address to the Congress around making a case that the greatest threat to the nation comes from what he describes as an open border through which drugs, criminals, and terrorists are flooding into the country, murdering innocent Americans in their beds while taking jobs from working-class Americans as the political elite remains comfortably ensconced inside gated communities walled off from the mayhem. We'll assess whether Trump's cynical use of Latinos as invading alien criminals and rapists, racist lies with which he began his presidential campaign, is still working as a means to divide America and justify the building of his wall, which he promised Mexico would pay for. Then we'll speak with best-selling author and veteran investigative journalist Charles Lewis, the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and author of 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Leadership. He joins us to dissect the stream of lies and exaggerations which issued forth from Trump last night to be greeted with ritual applause from Republicans springing to their feet like jack-in-the-boxes. We'll look into why Trump still has the support of 30 to 40% of the country, many of whom are fundamentalist Christians, who appear to be overlooking God's commandment that thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbor. Then finally, we'll examine how much the Democratic Party, in opposing any policy associated with Trump, are becoming the war party. Stephen Wertheim, a professor of U.S. history at Columbia University and the author of the forthcoming book Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Policy, Don't Let Democrats Become the Party of War. We will explore the dangers of the gambit by some Democrats to out-hawk Trump instead of rescuing and reviving diplomacy. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Laura Munoz-Lopez, a special assistant for immigration policy at the Center for American Progress, where she previously worked as a government relations associate at Network Lobby, where she managed the immigration and family-friendly federal policy portfolios. And she has an article at the Center for American Progress, Seven of the Top Immigration Lies from the Trump Administration. Welcome to Background Briefing, Laura Munoz-Lopez.
Thank you for having me.
And Laura, did you think last night in the State of the Union that President Trump was laying the groundwork for declaring a national emergency on the border? The way that he spent so much time building up this narrative of this enormous, dangerous border on the south we have, where the Democrats, you know, want open borders through which drugs, criminals, and terrorists are flooding into the country, murdering innocent Americans in their beds, and also taking jobs from working-class Americans while our political elite remain comfortably ensconced inside gated communities, walled off from the mayhem. That's the picture he painted. So why did he do that, do you think?
Yeah, I definitely think that that's the correct read on what he was trying to paint, and it's not any different of a reading that we have seen even when he started his presidential campaign in 2015. He's always used his time to attack immigrants, to spread lies, to try to equate immigrants to criminals, to say that there is a crisis at the border. A lot of these lies that we were, quite frankly, expecting at the State of the Union last night, because he did something very similar at last year's State of the Union, And so that's why, you know, here at the Center for American Progress, we wanted to write this column of the seven of the top immigration lies, because we need to debunk them, and we need the American public to be able to distinguish fact from fiction. So when he says that there is a crisis at the border, the fact is that there is a crisis. It's a humanitarian crisis because we do have asylum seekers, many of which are women and children, arriving at the border, fleeing violence and torture to seek asylum. It's not the crisis that he is talking about where it's just, you know, random immigrants coming through trying to come and steal jobs. That's not factually correct. It's asylum seekers. And his own U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency, CBP, their data shows that apprehensions at the southern border have declined more than 75% since 2000. So the facts are really clear, and they say the truth, unlike him.
But it's not that President Trump is demonizing immigrants. He's demonizing Latino immigrants. He actually said we should have more people coming in from Denmark at one point. He certainly doesn't demonize people from Slovenia, where his wife comes from. I mean, isn't it pretty clear that there's a racist component to this?
Oh, I definitely agree. Yeah, we know from the comment that he made when he was talking about African countries that he said a vulgarity about them. That was a very clear indication that he only wants immigrants in the United States that have certain skill sets and that come from certain countries. And unfortunately, the people of color, immigrants coming from African, Central American, South American countries, those are the ones that are getting the short end of the stick with these types of anti-immigrant proposals that he has put forth.
So which was the worst howler of this stream of lies and exaggerations that issued forth last night? One of the ones that got my attention was where he told this whole story about El Paso being this incredibly dangerous place, and then they put up a wall and now it's not dangerous anymore. And this has prompted the sheriff of El Paso to say very angrily, "The facts are clear. While it is true that El Paso is one of the safest cities in the nation, it has never been considered one of our nation's most dangerous cities," which is what Trump said. "And El Paso was a safe city long before any wall was built." So that's what one of the ones that struck me. But what was the one that struck you as being the worst of the seven? You're welcome to go through the seven quickly if you want to.
Well, what I do want to say about the El Paso thing, that the comment that he made, this is a clear example of Trump cherry picking information and trying to say that it's factually correct when it actually isn't. When you look at that at El Paso and their crime statistics, it was from 1993 to 2006 that crime actually dropped in El Paso, and it wasn't until 2006 that the border was authorized to start to be funded for construction, and construction didn't start until 2008. So if you look at the whole data, it tells a completely different story. So you're definitely correct, and the sheriff of El Paso is also correct. I would say that probably the biggest lie that we heard last night, which is often one that he refers to, is the fact that immigrants are bringing crime into the United States and that immigrants are criminal. In the column that I wrote with the seven lies, I talk about how the Cato Institute collected a bunch of research that was out there, and the research clearly shows that immigrants do not increase local crime rates. They're actually less likely to be convicted of crime than native-born Americans. And when you're comparing native-born Americans to undocumented immigrants, Cato also found that undocumented immigrants across the nation, across the United States, actually have lower rates of incarceration and are less likely to be incarcerated overall. And so while he uses the talking point of immigrants are coming across the border, they're killing family members and doing all these awful things, the facts say something completely different.
So, Laura Munoz-Lopez, what's the second or third, fourth, fifth or sixth or seventh big lie from last night?
Yeah, I mean, I can just go through the seven, and we pretty much debunked all of them. There were two glaring omissions from the speech that I definitely want to highlight. But definitely the fact that there is a crisis at the border. Like I said, apprehensions are down. When he talks about, you know, people arriving at the border in these caravans and, you know, paints them in this, that we should be afraid for our lives. The reality is that it's children and women and families coming seeking asylum. So that is definitely one of the biggest things that we should be highlighting. The fact that he says that the southern border is a pipeline for vast quantities of illegal drugs. The reality is that his own Justice Department, the DEA, found that most of the drugs coming into the United States are coming in at the ports of entry. The president likes to say that they're coming in between the ports, and that's why we need to build a wall. But that's simply not true. They're coming in through the ports in vehicles or people trafficking them. So that's a really important thing to remember, as well as the fact that the purest form of fentanyl, that really deadly strong opioid, is actually coming in through the mail. And that's not something that we hear from them often.
Right, it's coming from China, by the way.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah, the purest form.
So, but on the caravan, and I get some of my political information about the right wing in this country from the guy that cuts my hair. And the first thing he said the other day was, oh, God, this caravan. And I thought, what the hell is he talking about? Trump talked about it again last night, and he's deploying 3,750 more troops to the border.
Yeah, he did mention a number of troops for the deployment.
Mm-hmm. So that, we went through that in the last election, where there was a much larger caravan, which he demonized and said was full of Middle Eastern terrorists, and he sent troops down there in the first time. So this one is a much smaller caravan, but he's sending a lot of troops. So again, this is a game that he's playing, and I just wonder how much longer you can demonize Latinos to divide America to justify building this wall that Mexico promised to pay for.
Exactly. I mean, and, you know, the thing is that actually one of the most recent polls, of the American public about the wall, 60% of the American public opposes the wall. They do not want the wall to be built, and an even higher percentage think that that is not within the top priorities of what the administration should be focusing on. So you have the American public saying we do not want a wall. We also have the American public saying that they strongly support immigrants and immigration reform. We also have polls that show that the Trump administration, with their lies and nativist agenda, are turning off the American public. And yet we have him pushing for this wall, saying that we definitely need it. So it's really ironic. It's a contradiction of what the American people want versus what he's pushing. And that's one of the roles that we see at CAP, is pushing the facts, trying to get that out in the mainstream as much as possible, because the American people at the end of the day don't want the wall that he keeps saying they do.
Well, just in the last few seconds, are any of the Democratic candidates making the argument you just made? Somebody's got to push back against Trump.
Yeah, they definitely do. I think right now a lot of the attention is definitely focused with the fiscal year 2019 funding bill that they're trying to figure out in the next couple of days, or else we might be facing another shutdown over the wall. So I think a lot of members of Congress are focusing in on that. But hopefully in the next few days, we'll see them pushing more of these statistics and debunking the lies that the president and his administration spreads.
Well, Laura Munoz-López, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Laura Munoz-López, a Special Assistant for Immigration Policy at the Center for American Progress. She previously worked as a Government Relations Associate at Network Lobby, where she managed the immigration and family-friendly federal policy portfolios. And she has an article at the Center for American Progress, 7 of the Top Immigration Lies from the Trump Administration. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back dissecting the stream of lies and exaggeration which issued forth from Trump last night.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger traveling through this world below. There is no sickness no toil nor danger in that bright land to which I go.
That you want me to do? Yes, you have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah? Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going everything crazy that you want me to do. Get your hair, yeah, watch it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Charles Lewis, a best-selling author with over 30 years' experience as a national investigative journalist, a professor of journalism, and the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporters Workshop at the School of Communication at American University. He is a former producer for ABC News and 60 Minutes, as well as the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. His new book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Lewis.
Thanks for having me.
And it seemed to me that the future of truth and the decline of America's moral integrity was very much on display last night at the State of the Union. I found it actually very depressing that somebody could, representing this country before its own Congress, could just tell such a series of lies and exaggerations. And worse than that, his cheer squad, the Republicans, kept bouncing up on their feet like jack-in-the-boxes with ritual applause. So it's not just depressing. It also reminds you of how sort of hopelessly divided we are in terms of being in post-truth America.
Well, that's aptly described, post-truth America. That's kind of where we are. It's unbelievable, and it's totally appalling, of course. We've never had a president who lies as often as Donald Trump. No president close to that in terms of the numbers. The Washington Post has been very diligently tracking every statement, true or false, since he was a candidate, but since he's been president, he's already passed somewhere in the range of 6,500 lies since he's become president. So that's old news from November. I'm sure he may be up to 7,000 now. But no president has ever prevaricated this much in the modern era of, say, the last 50 to 70 years. Is simply unheard of.
But some of the lies are so easily refuted. He started off talking how the U.S. economy is growing twice as fast today as it was when I took office, and we are considered far and away the hottest economy anywhere in the world. Well, no. Latvia, Poland, they're growing twice as fast. China and India are growing twice as fast. Even the Greek economy, which has always been troubled lately, it's growing faster. I mean,
no, it's true. A lot of the fact checkers have pointed out what you just said, and the number of false statements last night is, I don't know the exact number, but I think it's somewhere more than 20 or 25 in a single night, which is ludicrous. And yes, the way they jumped up. We've all watched State of the Union addresses for a long time, over many decades, but I've never seen such a vocal and aggressive group of folks aligned with the president hopping up the way that they all did last night, almost like jack-in-the-boxes. I mean, it's very peculiar. All of those things that we saw last night were peculiar. But again, this president has zero regard for facts and truth, and which he's shown since when he was a candidate. He had five times more false statements or inaccurate statements than his opponent, Hillary Clinton, according to various fact checkers. There's simply no comparison with this particular president with anyone in the recent past.
And, And another one, of course, was that we've created 5.3 million new jobs and added 600,000 new manufacturing jobs. And the Bureau of Labor Statistics reports that the economy added 4.9 million jobs with 454,000 manufacturing jobs. So there again. Now, it seems to me that it's a very cynical tactic that he's using. I'm sure he knows he's lying. And he's lying for a constituency that believes him and thinks that the rest of the media propagate fake news. Would that explain it?
Well, yeah, I think so. His base is you know, frankly, a large number of folks who are not well educated. They're not deep into politics. They're not in the a lot of the, you know, more urban, more highly educated regions. A lot of them are in rural parts of the country. A lot of those parts of the country have what we now call news deserts, where there's no news source at all. So not only are they not paying attention to the news, they actually can't receive a whole lot of daily news of any note about their communities or their county or their state or even their country, or they don't want to. That's a whole other issue. When you have 5 to 7 hours of citizens in the United States watching TV every day, and almost all of that has nothing to do with news and facts, sports and movies and those kinds of things, distractions. We have essentially gradually, not just in the Trump era, but gradually we've been dumbing down the populace. I mean, a lot of the voters, the 40% who stand with Trump no matter what, and that they don't budge and they don't care what he says, what he does, they're still with him in the polls. That those numbers are, a lot of those folks are these loyal voters who he struck a nerve with them when he castigated and went up against the quote-unquote establishment. And, you know, he was the rebel billionaire, ironically, the rebel billionaire who lives in New York in a tower. But somehow he played to that base, which you can take that word in a number of ways, including the adjective. But anyway, yeah, we have watched this evolve over time, and that base, that hardcore base, hasn't changed all that much. It's still close to 40%, 35-40%, and it doesn't really matter what he does. He could be shown on a video shoplifting on, and they would say, well, you misinterpreted that. That's not what happened. He's a good man, and they would all stand with him. It's just unbelievable. So facts and truth are in the eye of the beholder, depending on their political allegiances or biases or whatever, and that's what is deeply alarming. And of course, this sort of autocratic approach to government and facts and everything else is become contagious in the last few years across the world. There are a number of folks who now use phrases like fake news, and they demonize other folks, and facts are not terribly relevant in those countries either. It's starting to become a really kind of disturbingly dark and cynical world out there, where trust in government, regardless of the country, almost is starting to become a significant problem. I mean, it is really a depressing time for the state of democracy itself. The whole idea of the public having some bearing in the decision-making process, caring about it, being responsible, paying attention to those things that are happening in government and power and decision-making, and there's a cynicism that they're all corrupt, that we don't like any of them, and we're going to ignore all of them, and or worse, we'll march against them, but we are not going to believe what they're saying. Or there will be factionalism where they declare everyone else lies, even when they don't. So, yeah, we're getting into a very precarious area, I think, when it comes to the state of governance in the U.S., but actually it's not confined to the U.S.,
And again, I'm speaking with Charles Lewis, who's a best-selling author with over 30 years' experience as a national investigative journalist, a professor of journalism, and the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the School of Communication at American University. But some of the lies, for example, it was interesting the way that he tried to suggest that being against or wanting this border wall was actually a moral stance, obviously responding to Nancy Pelosi's remark that it was immoral what was going on the border, because she was referring to snatching children from their parents. But he used that and tried to come across as a populist, and that he cared about working people and cast them as victims of immigrants coming up from the South. And in that context, he also talked about how he had lifted nearly 5 million Americans off food stamps. Well, again, that's not true. The actual number is 3.6 million, and one of the reasons why there's been a drop in the number of people on food stamps is because a lot of states have rolled back these recession-era waivers. And then you've got families with children who are American citizens. They've dropped out of the food stamps program because they're afraid of Trump's immigration policies somehow impacting them. And then the other one that's just an absolute disgraceful chestnut of a lie was that we virtually ended the estate or death tax on small businesses, ranches, and family farms. And that's when the Republicans really leapt to their feet. But in fact, the people who benefited are people earning more than, having more than $5 million. And according to the Tax Policy Center, nearly 5,550 states in 2017 out of nearly 3 million were subject to that tax. And of those, only 80 taxable estates would be farms and small businesses. So again, it's not just a lie. It's a conspiracy of lying, and they've known this. They've been saying this forever about small family farms. They know it's a lie, but they keep saying it because, it must be some sort of cynical calculation that it's working. But it's not just Trump. There's a lot of complicity out there.
Well, there is. And, everyone in our society, whether it's companies or government agencies or politicians, have their talking points, and they have specific things that they want to put forward, and they'll find something and round it up, it is true that there's a looseness and a lack of credibility and accountability, frankly, about these things. There's so much information. We're in a 24/7 culture with hundreds of millions of websites and population now upwards of 8 billion people. And so no one, and sound bites getting shorter and shorter, less than 6 seconds now to make a statement somewhere in the conventional news packages, video and audio. So we're an intense society, moving fast, always moving, and what people say, you can barely focus on the facts and the veracity of something because you're on to the next thing, whatever the next thing is. And it's 24/7. It's not just 8 hours a day or something like that. So it just keeps feeding on itself. And essentially, you end up with entrenched attitudes of people who will believe what they want to believe. And that's sort of, frankly, how Trump got elected. He had a hardcore base that essentially believed that Trump, because he played to them and struck their emotional chords and things, they would listen to and adhere to whatever he said because they felt that he cared about them. That the irony of ironies is this is a billionaire who didn't release his tax returns, who has had murky dealings with all kinds of places and numerous bankruptcies, and of course prevaricated quite a bit before he was ever a politician. And did shameless things like imitate, call up and say that he's an agent for Donald Trump when in fact it was Donald Trump calling, trying to get media coverage. So this guy has always been a huckster. He's always played fast and loose with facts. And somehow here we are at the end of a two-year tenure in a four-year term. And here's where we are. It's as grim as it sounded like it might become in the election when he told five times more lies than Hillary Clinton did in terms of accurate or inaccurate statements. So this is a problem. And then, sadly, to your point, there are folks who of the similar political ilk who have a similar agenda about who's important, who should be protected, which industries are sacred and which ones aren't, the distinctive similar views of the world, those folks don't really care if he's inaccurate or, you know, not fastidious with the facts, as long as he's standing with them. And so those powerful interests are essentially kowtowing to the lies themselves. They're willing to countenance such, you know, outrageous impudence about taking people for granted and lying to their face, because it's all about money and it's all about things they're trying to get and it's all about agendas and things. And it's just the way I think what worries me the most is the accountability. The whole subject of being accountable in the political realm is increasingly waning, it's fair to say. There is no one rushing, you know, marching on the White House after last night's speech, saying this guy lied about so many things, and he's, you know, past 7,000 lies now. This is unacceptable. At this point, the public is inured to it. We are at a place now where we're becoming numb to nonsensical comments and that are simply flatly untrue. We just kind of look the other way, or we just accept that this is a fella who has a hard time sticking to the facts, but some people find him highly entertaining despite that. It's just very strange and really disturbing. The health of this democracy is waning, I think it's fair to say. And the question is, where is all this going in the next couple of years?
Well, the only thing that can save us is democracy itself and another election, or perhaps even the Mueller inquiry. Because in 1974, President Nixon railed against in his State of the Union speech, railed against the Watergate and asked for it. He said that, you know, it's been going on for a year, you got to close it down. And Trump talked about this ridiculous partisan investigation and suggested that it would ruin the economic miracle that he was taking credit for and blowing up into far more than it actually meets the eye. But the sad part is that he does dominate the world stage, and he certainly was dominating the stage there in front of the Congress. And then when you cut to the rebuttal from Stacey Abrams, of course, it's completely unfair in the sense that, you know, she's got a handful of people behind her. She's not in front of the entire Congress. And even though she made a very good speech, it didn't really count. So it leads me to the final question here, Charles Lewis, and that is, where is the opposition? I don't see anybody. You know, you've got, 20 Democrats running? As bad as this guy is, you would think that this country could produce an alternative leader that could lead us out of this wilderness.
Well, you would. I mean, and of course, there's 20, and actually by the time a year from now when the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, all those things start to play out for a presidential election, you'll probably have 30 prominent Democrats. In every presidential election, there's usually over 200 candidates. It's just the media, and for the sake of all of our sanities, we only focus on those who are well-known or respected as public servants, you know, who are serving in the House or Senate or a governor's office or something. So this Democratic field is going to get more crowded in that sense, and we're not going to – all that's going to take a year to play out, or just under a year now. New Hampshire, I guess, is probably in Iowa. It's probably January 2020. But so that's one issue, is the timing factor. There's also a very interesting drama going on in the House of Representatives. Now that the Democrats control the House, there's clearly a caution to go too far, too fast when the subject of impeachment. And it's gotten so far that recently the actor Robert Redford, who is, you know, a devoted Democrat as well, he and others are saying, do not do impeachment. You're going to have a robust presidential campaign, which has actually already begun, and it won't go through the U.S. Senate anyway, because the Republicans control the Senate. So why bother and tear the country up? Just go for a clean slate. And so there's this internal debate inside the Democratic Party of how to handle all of this. There's some who are anxious to try to impeach or go, you know, investigate further. There's some question whether the Mueller report will be completely released. There's a lot of distrust about the new Attorney General Barr, and there is some reason to be suspicious or at least concerned about whether or not the full report by Mueller will be released. The cynical part of all of us thinks, well, it'll be leaked if it's not released, and that may be true. We have a chaotic situation here on a number of levels. Will the Mueller report be released? What kind of candidates are going to emerge? Can the House representatives do full-scale investigations in one or more committees and come around the corner to things like impeachment resolutions if they were so inclined to do it and willing to do it and having the spine to do it? So I lived through Watergate. I was in Washington during 1974 working for a senator in the midst of Watergate. And I also investigated Abscam, where 8 members of Congress went to prison for corruption. So I've seen these things. And in this case, this is playing very, very fast. And you'll notice the Democrats are not racing or sprinting to have impeachment hearings. They're starting to have some hearings, but they're doing it very cautiously and carefully, which can be seen as ideal and laudable in terms of being responsible. But the fact is, the clock is ticking, and we're already in another presidential election, which is, of course, sheer lunacy, but that's our culture. We have 2-year presidential campaigns for a 4-year tenure in office. It's very strange. So, you know, that we have a very dysfunctional, peculiar democracy set up in our democracy about elections, and no country on earth has elections as long as America has, as expensive. The last election, Trump got $5.8 billion in free media just from bloviating and talking all the time on TV and everything in news interviews, free media, basically. Hillary Clinton raised $1.4 billion directly and also indirectly through another organization. He raised $600 million, but again had $5.8 billion in free media. So we're the only country that has 2-year presidential campaigns for a 4-year election. We're the only advanced country, or one of the few advanced countries on earth, that also does not have free airtime for politicians given to them. I've interviewed former President Jimmy Carter, who decried the fact that there is no easy way for regular folks to even attempt running for office, and also the length of the campaigns, and that there's no free media because the broadcast industry will not allow that, by the way. They've blocked it repeatedly for 10 or 20 years. So,
well, they make a fortune. They make a fortune out of these.
They make a massive amount. They make over $1 billion every 2-year election cycle, and it's going higher every year. So we're in a place where it's a cliche, but as a country, we've painted ourselves into a corner. And in a way, perhaps that's how we ended up with a Donald Trump in the first place, because of the tortuous, bizarre way that we elect our leaders to begin with. But then on top of that, we have a leader who, for all intents and purposes, is out of control.
Well, Charles Lewis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Charles Lewis, who's a best-selling author with over 30 years' experience as a national investigative journalist, a professor of journalism, and the founding executive editor of the Investigative Reporting Workshop at the School of Communication at American University. He's also a former producer for ABC News and 60 Minutes, as well as the founder of the Center for Public Integrity and the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And his new book is 935 Lies, The Future of Truth and the Decline of America's Moral Integrity. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Democratic Party, in opposing any policy associating with Trump, are becoming the party of war.
Mm-hmm. down by the riverside, down by the riverside.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Wertheim. He's a professor of U.S. history at Columbia University. He researches U.S. foreign relations and international order from the 19th century to the present, with a special focus on concepts of politics and law. His forthcoming book is Tomorrow the World, The Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II. And he has an article in Foreign Policy, Don't Let the Democrats Become the Party of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Wertheim.
Thanks for having me.
And last night in the State of the Union, of course, the president in effect bookended the speech in many ways with World War II heroes, the Greatest Generation, survivors of the death camps, along with those that liberated it, talked about storming the beaches at D-Day. So to some extent, he is bringing back World War II, but at the same time, you know, the irony is, of course, World War II led to NATO, and he seems to want to get out of NATO. So I know it may be asking too much to find some consistency in President Trump's foreign policy outlook, but what did you make of that aspect of last night's speech?
I certainly thought that the speech emphasized the scattershot nature of his foreign policy to date. He would jump from, I mean, he had this line that great nations do not fight endless wars, which I thought was quite a good line. But on the other hand, he ratcheted up pressure once again on Iran, spoke of a kind of neocon-style regime change operation, which has not become militarized, in Venezuela. So it's really hard to find much consistency in his message. I would say that with respect to the formation of NATO, NATO was really created at the end of the 1940s as a military alliance against Soviet-backed communism. So one could argue that there's a difference between what the United States was intending to do in the post-war world as of 1945, when it set up the Universal United Nations with the Soviet Union as a permanent member, and the NATO alliance. And I'd also say that President Trump has, of course, expressed a lot of skepticism of NATO, but the thrust of his criticisms has always been that he wants the NATO allies to pay more. Of course, he's undermined that by consistently ramping up the U.S. military budget, which is not a very good way to convince anyone to pay more. But I'm very skeptical of the idea that he actually does want to leave NATO.
Well, that was one of the biggest inconsistencies that I thought was, and I agree with him, that we shouldn't be bogged down in endless wars. But if we're getting out of these endless wars and they appear to be winding down, why do we have a defense budget of $716 billion?
Exactly. It seems to be that his rationale for America's military supremacy, which he wants to bolster, is kind of a cultural one. It's about getting tough with the world, not so much leading an international order or even having one overarching geopolitical or ideological enemy. So it's quite a different rationale for American military supremacy. But Trump is absolutely an advocate of American military supremacy. I've always thought from the beginning he was much more of a militarist than a quote-unquote isolationist, which a lot of mainstream commentators have painted him as.
Well, the Democrats have always been the kind of Me Too party in terms of throughout the Cold War. They wanted to be just as tough on the Soviets as the Republicans. And in the so-called War on Terror, they wanted to be just as tough as the Republicans on the terrorists, simply because the Republicans always tried to question their patriotism. And now they're, of course, being accused of being soft on the border and encouraging a socialist takeover of the United States, which I must say is pretty farcical.
That's right. It's a strange time for the Democratic Party. And obviously the piece that I wrote with Trita Parsi encourages the Democratic Party to seize the initiative on promoting peace and diplomacy and not become more hawkish. But they are finding that in a way, Trump and the Republicans have actually come up with a new kind of rationale for what the United States is doing in the world. And the Democrats are reacting to that rather than innovating with their own response.
So elaborate on that, if you will.
Well, I think what Trump pretty distinctively has done is he has positioned the United States against globalism and certain global flows, especially of non-white immigrants. That is his main kind of rationale for what the United States is in the world. He's also dispensed with the typical American exceptionalism in which the United States is a model for all others and cast the United States as an aggrieved victim in the world, which everyone else, including American allies, is taking advantage of. And this is a whole worldview that really departs from the Cold War era battle against totalitarianism that neoconservatives and the George W. Bush administration continued to try and force the post-Cold War world into, with ideas like Islamofascism to describe the al-Qaeda terrorist threat. But Trump has really got a different kind of rationale for what the United States is doing in the world, and Democrats have largely been reactive.
Well, the Democrats, obviously, I mean, what was appalling last night was to see the leader of the free world lie, exaggerate, posture, and so forth. And you can probably tell that I'm no fan of his, which, by the way, the majority of the American people are not a fan of his. But as much as it's distressing to see this man represent the United States in front of the world, and not to mention in front of the U.S. government, what's wrong with the Democrats? There's no leadership coming from them. So it's not just that we're talking about them becoming the party of war. They've got to become the party of something.
That's certainly true. And, you know, I think a lot of discussion goes back to, well, why did the Democrats lose the last election? That is the presidential election of 2016. And I think we should remember that the main message of the Hillary Clinton campaign was opposition to Donald Trump. She even welcomed Republicans into the fold to make this kind of common cause, and it didn't work. So that, for me, is a point of departure in terms of thinking about what the Democrats need to do going forward.
Well, it would seem, though, at least to articulate what the real challenges in the world are, and in spite of Trump suggesting that the socialists were about to take over the United States, the truth of the matter is I don't detect ideology being an issue anymore on the global stage. It's not a battle between communism and capitalism. It seems to be more of a battle between encroaching kleptocracies and autocracies versus frail democratic institutions and democratic states.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. That's a key dynamic of what's going on. There's also, I think, an emerging fault line between there's a bipartisan group that thinks that the United States should be very concerned with great power competition, first against Russia, but also against China. That's something that Trump himself has encouraged, and a lot of the bipartisan establishment has actually said he's got a point. And then there's another coalition forming on the flanks of each party. And here's where I think the Democrats do show signs of innovation. This bipartisan coalition is in favor of significant political military restraint and has focused for now on, trying to get the United States to end its support for Saudi Arabia's war in Yemen. That's a measure that will be advanced in the House probably very soon. And we've seen progressives in Congress, like Congressman Ro Khanna, articulating a quite fresh non-interventionist approach.
Well, arguably the Cold War ended because of rock and roll and MTV rather than the number of missiles pointing at each other. And now, of course, in the speech last night, Trump, in ending the INF treaties, said that we're going to outspend and out innovate, I think he said, both China and Russia. So he was inviting a new arms race. So what happened to the lessons of soft power? Why are we forgetting the power of soft power, particularly, and why aren't the Democrats picking up on it? I mean, I would have thought given the framing of the real challenges between the survival of democracy versus the encroachment of kleptocracy and autocracy being the main global challenge, well, you know, you could paint Trump into the box of being soft on kleptocrats and autocrats, for God's sake.
Absolutely. I have the same question as you do, and I don't know that I have a great answer for it. But if you look at some of the things that the article discusses, if you look at the Democratic leadership's response to the few instances in which Trump has tried to pursue a diplomatic path, as with North Korea, or has actually at least announced an intention to withdraw some troops in the case of Syria and now Afghanistan, their reaction has actually seemed to be going in the opposite direction, that is to be very skeptical of these approaches and to fetishize military power as the essence of American engagement in the world.
So what do you think is going to be the narrative then in this election year? Unfortunately, it's already begun. There are about 20-odd people competing. And your sense is that the neocons, I guess they're like cockroaches. They keep coming back, right?
They do. And we've seen, I wrote a piece in the New York Review of Books last month about the way in which neocons, who you might have thought would be done after they lost a foothold in their main political party, the Republican Party, 2 years ago, they've come back on both sides of the Trump divide, making alliances with mainstream Democrats against Trump and also making alliances with the Trump administration and in some cases serving very prominently in that administration. So that is a remarkable thing. They have cockroached their way yet again to considerable and undeserved influence. But I think that we are facing a different moment. We are facing a genuinely uncertain moment about what the basic purpose of American power in the world is. I'm not sure anyone has a really compelling answer to that question right now, and that means that the future is open in a way that we haven't seen, I think, for several decades since the 1990s. And you'll notice that people keep going back to the 1990s to say, you know, actually things went wrong then. Now, one view is that the United States was too welcoming of other actors like China and Russia into the so-called U.S.-led liberal international order. Another view articulated by some academics like Stephen Walt and John Mearsheimer in their recent books calls for restraint and says the United States was too ambitious and too belligerent at that time, and we've been paying the price for it since. So I genuinely don't know. It's a depressing conclusion for an interview, but I genuinely don't know what's going to happen, and I think that's rather interesting.
But why isn't the reality staring us in the face that the real power that the U.S. seems to have today doesn't rest in the Pentagon? It rests in the Treasury Department with red notices and such. You know, it's true that it's a tool that can be abused and to the point where Russia and China and other countries will find an alternative around the dollar. But as long as the dollar remains the reserve currency, the U.S. has immense power. And you can see the use of power in terms of sanctioning Russian oligarchs, et cetera,
yes,
is really a very powerful tool. So why are we so blind to the obvious here?
Yeah, it's an excellent point again. And again, it seems as though the presence of U.S. ground troops in particular dominates all the energy when it comes to U.S. foreign policy discourse. You know, 2,000 ground troops in Syria prompted James Mattis to resign, as of all the things that have happened in the Trump administration to that point, that's what prompted Mattis to resign and prompted a kind of bipartisan freakout. Meanwhile, you're right, what the Trump administration has done with its heavy use of sanctions, its use of so-called secondary sanctions against Iran, is to really incentivize other actors to start to wean themselves away from U.S. financial dominance. And that is a significant story. It's going to take some time if there is a reconfiguration of power in that regard. So we don't quite see the results immediately, but this is something to watch going forward.
Well, just in closing, the first act, one of the first acts of Trump's was, of course, to get out of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that was organized, essentially it was a trade deal, but it was also a geopolitical arrangement to sort of force China to become more transparent in terms of its governance, more democratic, if you will, and certainly play by the rules, because the entire neighborhood would be organized against them. So they would be eventually have to join in a regime that would cause them to liberalize. And you notice the minute that Trump pulled out of the TPP, Xi Jinping then turns the screws, the Communist Party comes back, censorship comes back. And so again, it seems that these multilateral organizations like the EU and the TPP and other arrangements that Trump has gone against on the advice of Bannon, which I, for the life of me, I don't understand what their thinking is. These are powerful tools that are that have been squandered while we're spending $716 billion on a military we can't use.
I think that's right. And I would add to that, though, that the administration hasn't just discarded or discredited certain multilateral alliances and institutions. It is also starting to be rather effective in reorienting some of the core, especially North Atlantic alliances against Chinese economic power. If you look at recent actions in terms of 5G networks, the administration is actually getting its way in trying to box out Chinese corporations. And this is something that I think some scholars call it geoeconomics. And this is something I think will be quite significant in the future, regardless of whether we have a Democratic or different Republican administration. And you also see this with respect to the administration's diplomacy toward Latin America. The ability of the administration to rally North Atlantic states to delegitimize and remove recognition of the Maduro government is quite significant. So, on the one hand, there has been a discrediting and destruction of certain multilateral arrangements. On the other hand, the administration has begun to create a kind of different power structure.
Well, we should revisit this conversation. I'm afraid we've run out of time. But I think your warning that the Democrats could become the party of war is well taken. And I hope I hope they're listening. And I thank you for joining us.
Hope so, too.
I thank you for joining
thank
us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Wertheim. He's a professor of U.S. history at Columbia University. He researches U.S. foreign relations and international order from the 19th century to the present, with a special focus on concepts of politics and law. And his forthcoming book is Tomorrow, the World, the Birth of U.S. Global Supremacy in World War II. And he has an article at Foreign Policy Magazine, Don't Let the Democrats Become the Party of War. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Evan Green. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.
A lady dressed in white with a man she loved.